Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
I'm Kathy with a K.
And I'm Kathy with a C.
And this is Killer Destinations. Today's destination is Moffat, Scotland. This small burg of Moffat today boasts almost 2,500 residents and is located in the heart of southern Scotland. The origins date back to the 12th century, but it was the discovery in 1663 of healing natural springs in the area that transformed Moffat to a destination town. Almost 300 years later, the image of the town of Moffat was once again transformed when, in 1936, it was the epicenter of bringing forensic science into the modern age of an alleged murderer.
On a Sunday afternoon in September of 1935, Susan Johnson and her mother were on vacation in Scotland. As they walked along a scenic part of Edinburgh Road in Moffat, they stopped at this scenic overlook, which was known by residents and tourists to be a beautiful place to enjoy the scenery. As they watched the swirling river below the bridge that they were standing on, Susan noticed something down below on the riverbank, and she asked her mom, "What do you think that looks like?" And the mom was kind of checking it out, and Susan says, "I think it looks like a human arm." And her mother was absolutely not. That does not look like an arm. It's not an arm.
Because they're in Scotland, I believe she pish-poshed it.
I think she pish-poshed it.
Pish-posh.
But I can't do a Scottish accent. So she.
I'm going for like an American English version of it.
Exactly. So she pish-poshed it. And she said to Susan, "To me, it looks like a tree with the bark stripped off." So Susan and her mom went back to their hotel, and Susan could not get this out of her mind. So she told her brother about it, who, of course, being the curious boy that he was,
exactly,
he immediately went and got a friend, and the two of them climbed down the ravine and got to this object. And in fact, it was a human arm. So as these two young men were on this riverbank in shock by what they're looking at, they actually look around and notice for the first time a bunch of bundles on the riverbank around them. And they're wrapped in newspaper, whatever these objects are. So the boys immediately fear, these are more body parts. We have to get the police. So they went back to their hotel, called the police, and sure enough, the police show up, start opening these newspaper-wrapped objects, and confirmed that they were other human body parts. So the police found 14 different bundles, and some of them were on the bank of the river. Some of them were caught in the bushes along the river, and they were wrapped in different things, not just old newspaper, it turns out. They were also wrapped in clothing. They were wrapped in sheets, and they were covered with maggots. And apparently, Kath, the stench was overwhelming.
Oh, I can't imagine decomp.
Yeah, no.
Like that. Mm-mm.
So as police started unwrapping these bundles, they found two heads, 2 feet, a forearm, a hand, pieces of human flesh, and
like
bones.
Chunks of human flesh, right?
Chunks of human flesh. Night fell. The officers had to resume their search in the morning, and they found a forearm with fingers clenched into a fist that had been cut off at the elbow. The body parts were taken to a local mortuary, and two doctors spent hours and hours piecing them back together. And what they discovered was that once the puzzle pieces, so to speak, were put together, it was a man and a woman. A total, Kathy, of I think 70 body parts were eventually found throughout the area and used to recreate these individuals.
But Kathy, what was interesting is, as you said, they put together this bone puzzle, as it were, And there were a couple of parts that were missing, the most important of which actually was one of the bodies, the body of the man, was missing his entire torso. So they had a lot of people looking down the length of the river because it did wash out to the sea off on tributaries, because their fear was if something got far enough down the river, it was going to be lost to the ocean. They're waiting for the torso still, obviously, because they need this to help them identify who these people are. The doctors in the mortuary who were putting this together said that they believed the woman was about 35 to 40 years old, and the man was a bit older at 45 to 50. What they also discovered as they were putting these bodies together, because even though there was decomposition, there was still skin on the people. They could still see what had happened in some parts. And they determined that both of them had been savagely beaten and stabbed. Because of how the body parts were detached, they could not determine a cause of death. With the man, they didn't know, was he stabbed in the heart? They didn't have intact necks, so were they asphyxiated? There was just no way for them to tell yet. The other two things that they realized, Kathy, is that the torsos were cut up after death, and they could tell this by how the blood had clotted. They also said that the ears and eyes of both the man and the woman had been indescribably mutilated.
I thought that was interesting when we were going over this before this recording, because ears are such a very specific point of identification. I wonder if it was like that in 1935. I don't know. I don't know if that was a thing. It's a very distinct science.
Right. They have three piercings. They have, you know, whatever. No, but it's true.
Like, but it's like ear shape.
Yeah. No, I agree. Know? And my guess is it had to have been, because why would they have taken the time to do it?
Yeah, I don't know.
After all this has been done, they actually take both of the bodies and they send them to professors of forensic science at the University of Glasgow and the University of Edinburgh. Now that they've done as much as they can with the bodies at this point, the police start looking for other ways they can determine not only how these people were killed, but when and where. They turned initially to the newspapers, because most of these objects were wrapped with newspaper. As you said, some had clothing, some had bed sheets, but they were hoping that the newspapers would tell them where it happened. All of the newspapers were from a newspaper called the Daily Record, and they published in both Scotland and England. The newspaper had different versions that it published in the different areas, reflecting the local interests and needs at the time. Initially, Kath, they believed that these two people, the man and the woman, had been dumped there by somebody from England. And their reasoning behind that was that they said where they were found in Moffat, in this ravine, was just about the right amount of distance from where they were in England, in northern England, for an Englishman to decide it was far enough away for them to dump it, they could still get home.
Oh, that's
kind of funny.
And
so they wouldn't be missing for too long. However, the two things they discovered initially from the newspapers was that all of the newspapers were dated September 2nd, which was about 3 weeks before the bodies were found. And these were all Scottish editions. So their theory that it was English got tossed out, and now they had to start looking locally. So the Moffat police contacted the other Scottish police offices, asking them about any missing persons who had been reported to see if any of them could have potentially matched this man and woman who they had found. But unfortunately, they had very little to go on in terms of the description of these two people. They didn't have eye color, obviously. They only had hair color for the woman, and it was light brown. They both looked to be rather small, and that was it. So nothing came from that. But Kathy, here was my favorite newspaper hyperbole. Loved it, loved it, loved it. The article started with, and I'm going to read it so I can get it correctly, and I might add some drama to it, as it I'm sure was received at the time. Never in the history of crime has there been such a gathering of crime investigators as has congregated in Moffat in an effort to solve the mystery of the double murder. I love that. Thank you. Thank you.
Too,
thank
I
you.
Wish you could do a Scottish accent, though.
I know. I know. I can't. I wouldn't even try.
Right. Exactly. So 5 days after the bodies were found, police actually found more remnants of the crime, and they found a newspaper that was actually dated September 15th. So they now knew that whoever went missing after September 15th. And this was actually 2 weeks prior to the bodies being found. So now they've closed the window to a 2-week time frame. So it appeared to investigators and the doctors involved in putting the pieces of the puzzle back together, so to speak, that the individuals had been drained of their blood before they were cut up. And so police decided that perhaps somebody with veterinary experience was involved.
Or a butcher.
Exactly, exactly. Detectives published pictures in the newspaper of some of the articles of clothing that had been wrapped around the body parts. For example, they published a photograph of a child's romper as well as a woman's blouse.
It's interesting that they did that too, because it's not like in 1935 they were going to Target.
Right.
Everybody's right. going to have something different.
Exactly. And likely homemade.
Right.
Unfortunately, that led police nowhere. Nobody came forward and said, I recognize that blouse. I recognize that baby clothing. Nothing. Again, a week after the body was discovered, detectives also figured out that it wasn't just newspapers from Scotland. They were also from England. And these newspapers that they found, they were specific editions for a particular area of England.
Which was Northern England.
Mm-hmm. And so now they have a 2-week time frame with missing persons that's now expanded to England.
You know, the officers who at first were like, oh, it was those bloody Brits who did it.
Yeah.
And then somebody was like, nuh-uh. Now they're going, ha ha ha.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was around this time that detectives published more information on the woman. She was younger than they initially thought, and they estimated that she was between 20 and 22 years old. They know that she had brown hair. They estimated she was 5'1", very, very small. And they said she had a fairly small head. Which I thought was interesting.
Exactly.
On further description, the woman, now this is a quote from the newspaper, the woman was one of the working class, but it was ruled out that she was a tramp or a manual worker.
We're debating if their definition of tramp was hobo.
Right.
Or prostitute.
Right. And so I don't know what the answer is. I'm leaning more toward hobo.
I'm leaning more towards prostitute.
I know. That's because that's how you think. But anyway. So there wasn't much additional information about the man, but the police did refer to him as Lantern Jawed. And Kathy looked that up. Why don't you tell us what Lantern Jawed means?
It's usually a man who has a very long, prominent chin. And because it's such a long chin, it gives them the appearance of being emaciated or gaunt. But then 11 days after the body parts were found, and just a couple of days after this new information about the man and the woman, there was a shocking reversal of what the doctors were saying. Now, remember, it had gone from the mortuary doctors to the professors of anatomy in Glasgow and Edinburgh. It turned out that the mutilated remains and body parts they had found added up to 2 women, not a man and a woman. One day after they determined that it was 2 women, the remains of the female was identified. She was 19-year-old Mary Rogerson from Northern England, just outside of the city of Lancaster. Her parents had reported her missing at the beginning of October because Mary worked as a nursemaid. She had originally been a nurse, but then she was hired by a family, a doctor and his wife in Lancaster, to watch over their 3 children. And she was a live-in nursemaid. But on the days that she had off, she would obviously go back to her parents and stay with them. And they hadn't seen her in a couple of weeks. So that's why they filed the missing persons report. After identifying Mary, they went to talk to Dr. Buck Ruxton, who was the doctor who employed Mary, along with his wife, Isabella Ruxton, and their 3 small children. Dr. Ruxton told detectives that he had last seen Mary on the morning of September 15th. She had left the house after her shift and told them that she was going on a holiday for a couple days, but she had never returned. And it was at that point, though, Kath, that Dr. Ruxton decided to share with investigators that September 15th was also the date that he had last seen his wife, Isabella. But he told them he knew where she was, or at least knew who she was with, because he said that his wife had been having an affair and had run away with this other man, which was why he never reported her missing. But as you can imagine, the detectives were like, huh, that's still kind of weird. She left 3 kids at home, didn't say anything, and just bolted. let's find out who this guy is. So Dr. Ruxton was actually born and raised in India. This was when India was part of the British Empire. And he was raised in a very wealthy family. He was considered to be very intelligent. And he actually went to medical school. Now, about the time that he was 24 or 25, he was married in an arranged marriage, but didn't really take, or at least for him.
Yeah.
So he left his wife behind in India, no divorces, and he toddled on off to England because he got a job there working as a doctor.
So can I interject a story?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm going to anyway.
I know. I knew my answer wouldn't affect that at all.
So when my number four child was 10 months old, she was hospitalized with some...
It was horrific.
Yeah.
It was horrific.
Yeah. She was hospitalized for 10 days. They told my husband and I that she had leukemia, all this kind of stuff. And it turns out she did not have leukemia. She had a bone infection, osteomyelitis. But it was so scary being in the hospital. And we're in the wing of a children's hospital. And there's another bed. And there was this little Indian boy. I still remember his name. I will not say it. But he was 3 years old. And he spent a lot of time in the hospital. So his dad would usually come a little bit at night. Both of his parents were Indian. And his mom would spend a lot of time during the day there. And I was like at the hospital almost 24/7. Like my husband would come spend the night when I just got too tired to be there anymore. Anyway, we were all, whatever, at the hospital all the time. Anyway, so this one night, the little boy in the crib next to my daughter was still awake and it was really late. It was like 11 o'clock. And so I went and I started reading him books and in comes his mom at like 11:15 at night. And I was so surprised. I'm like, oh, and he was parents were very germ phobic. And so I'm like, I didn't touch him. I was just reading him a book to put him to sleep. And she's like, no, it's okay. So anyway, so she and I get to talking and somehow, people, I always ask questions.
She always asks very personal questions.
I totally do. I totally do. I can get to know somebody in like 10 minutes, I swear. But anyway, so I find out that she is in an arranged marriage and I was fascinated by that. And, but she was living here. She and her husband both had a very successful business, but his parents and her parents knew each other from India and blah, 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 blah.
Wait, so it was arranged in the United States?
It was arranged in the United States, but they flew back to India to have it, okay? So I'm like, oh my God, that's so cool. So the next day, I say, I love Indian food. Totally looking to scam a meal. Sure enough, the next night, she brings, oh my God, it
sure
was so
enough,
good.
You knew she was going to do that.
I was praying. Like she brought chicken korma, chicken tikka masala.
Here,
oh my God. She brought chana masala. She all this delicious Indian food she brings in. We're having a feast. And then she had these like, I don't even know what they'd be, like VHS tapes mm-hmm. of her wedding in India.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, we sat in the hospital room till late at night eating Indian food and watching her legit Indian wedding.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah. And
Kathy's never seen her again.
She's, I know. But if you're out there, and I know you know who you are, thank you for the food.
Back to the story.
Yep.
Back to Dr. Buck Ruxton.
Who went from England, or excuse right. me, from India to England.
Correct. Now, after a year in England, however, he moved to Scotland. He'd been accepted into the Royal College of Surgeons for postgraduate work. He toddles on off now to Scotland. One of the first things he did, or maybe the first thing, is that he changed his name. Because his name wasn't always Buck Ruxton. He was born as Bukhtiar Hakim. And so Ruxton is a much more decidedly British name.
Definitely.
So that's when he did that. He also started hanging out at a cafe where he met one of the waitresses there named Isabella and fell in love with her. So here's the problem.
A weird problem.
Buck had been married and walked away and just sent the wife back to India. No divorce. He did not share this with Isabella. But Isabella also had a secret. And she had been married for only a few months to a Dutch merchant seaman, and she didn't really like how that was going either, so she left too.
Did she not divorce as well?
Did not divorce him.
So the two married people found each other and fell in love.
Exactly. And then moved to London about a year later when he got a job there. So they moved there together as man and wife. That's how they presented themselves. Everybody called her Mrs. Ruxton, but they were never married. Now, they don't actually have common law marriages in England or in the UK. Actually, I heard Scotland today is a little different. Back in 1935, they didn't have that at all.
And usually if you have common law, you know, there's statutes, there's codes that basically say, okay, you live together so many years, you know, whatever, you milk a cow together, you twist in a circle three times, you're married.
That's just where Kathy's from.
Something like that. But everyone in the universe believed them to be married.
1 year after arriving in London, they had their first child, a daughter, Elizabeth. And just a couple of years after that, they moved to Lancaster in northern England, where Buck opened his own practice in the first floor of the family's three-story home. Now, this is, again, in England, 35. All the homes are attached, but they're the very large ones, kind of like you still see in New York. So the first floor was all his practice. Second and third were family and living quarters. Buck was really well-respected in this new medical practice. All of the patients thought that he was very compassionate, very hardworking, and he was actually very generous, because if people came to him with either themselves being sick or a sick child and could not pay, he still treated them. 1 year later, they had their second daughter up in Lancaster, a little girl named Diana. And then 2 years after that, they had their third and final child, a son named Billy.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
So when detectives are talking to Dr. Buck Ruxton about his missing wife and nursemaid, he admits to them when they moved to Lancaster, Isabella was having a difficult time. She had three kids. She was helping him with his medical practice. She was doing sort of administrative and secretarial things and bringing in patients, et cetera, et cetera. And she was kind of reaching a breaking point. And so they hired 19-year-old Mary Rogerson as a nursemaid to help her care for the kids. Buck did admit to detectives that he and his wife fought and that he accused her of cheating. Buck told detectives, again, the last time he saw his wife Isabella was on the morning of September 15th, and this was the same day he last saw his nursemaid Mary, who had taken a couple days off to go on a holiday. On the 14th, the day prior, Isabella, his wife, had gone to a northwest coastal town in England to meet her sisters. So the last time he saw her was at 1:30 in the morning. Now, this is the wee hours of the 15th. She had gone to the town of Blackpool, which was about 30 miles away from Lancaster, and she had done so to meet her sisters. She returned at 1:30 in the morning, which made her husband
suspicious. Let's see.
Yes, exactly. She had gone to a lights festival, basically. I'm assuming it's like an Aurora Borealis sort of thing. I don't know.
It was called the Illuminations. Kind of sounds like a band.
Exactly. Getting home in the wee hours, as we said, confirmed his belief that she was having an affair. And the next day she left. So she left on the 15th, which further confirmed in his mind that she had run off with this mysterious lover, and he hadn't seen her since. So 2 weeks after these body remains were found, Dr. Buck Ruxton was arrested for the murder of Mary Rogerson. As it turned out, about 5 days after she went missing, Buck went to her parents and told her parents that their daughter, 19-year-old Mary, had gotten pregnant and that his wife, Isabella, was trying to arrange a termination of the pregnancy, but that wasn't legal in England. Buck tells Mr. and Mrs. Rogerson, please do not tell the police because Mary's going to get in trouble if you do. And so they don't do it. But a week later, they come to his medical practice and they said, hey, have you heard from Isabella or Mary? What's going on? And at this point, what he tells Mr. and Mrs. Rogerson is that Mary and Isabella had broken into his safe and stolen over $2,000.
Well, it was 30 pounds. Oh. Doing my equivalency.
Oh, I see. So the doctor tells Mr. and Mrs. Rogerson, I'm not sure where they went. I'm not sure when they'll come back, but I'm sure it'll be soon, as soon as they're done spending the money. Something like that. So at this point, the Rogersons are now suspicious.
They had to have been freaked out, don't you think?
Oh, God, yes.
First, it was a pregnancy termination, and then it was off whooping it up with the mistress of the house?
Yeah, totally. But because the difference in the stories out of this doctor's mouth were so odd, they were like, no, 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 no. We have to report our daughter missing. And they did. And so that is how detectives identified the body as Mary Rogerson's.
That was the turning point. Trial began fewer than 6 months later in March of 1936. Dr. Buck Ruxton pleaded not guilty, and his jury was comprised of 12 men.
Were they 12 angry men?
Probably. But no women.
No women. Well, you couldn't, like, no, women didn't serve on juries back then.
Can you trust them?
Who can trust a woman?
They would have gotten all emotional.
Honest to God.
I mean,
you know how women are.
I know. Buck was being tried only for Isabella's murder, not Mary's.
So he was charged with Mary's murder initially.
Right.
And then they took that off the table and they charged him with Isabella's murder. But we don't know why. We right. could not find anything.
Anything.
And so we were actually debating, is it because of her lower station in life? We
could've
don't
been.
Know. But also it could have been something as simple as, what's his motivation? There was no evidence that we could see that Mary had ever crossed him.
Right. So Crown Prosecutor J.C. Jackson opened the trial by quoting Shakespeare, as we like them to do, as you know. He said, quote, "Trifles light as air, which to the jealous mind are confirmed true as holy writ."
Isn't End that quote. Funny how you don't even know what the hell that means?
I'm assuming he's, but you know what, like, we know what it means, at least in our poor little American minds. I mean, my assumption is he's basically saying you get an idea in your head about the jealousy
right.
and every little thing you're going to look at incorrectly and blow it up until and somebody dies.
And it becomes gospel.
Exactly. In his opening statement, the prosecutor put forth his belief based on evidence that in the early morning hours of September 15th, as we said, Isabella came home. It was really late slash early in the morning. And Buck knew at that point it meant that she had been cheating on him. She had been with another man and he killed her in an absolute rage. And Mary was simply collateral damage because she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And Kath, here's actually what came out too. Despite Mary being hired, as you said, to help ease the burden, the marriage between Isabella and Buck was not a happy one. Neighbors often heard them shouting, and sometimes the shouting was so bad that the neighbors would call the police. And Kathy, in fact, once 2 years before Isabella was murdered, she actually called the police herself and reported that her husband had beaten her. The police responded, but no action was taken, including no report was written. Now, the prosecutor declared that both women, Isabella and Mary, were murdered outside the maid's bedroom. They said they knew that this was the case because, based on evidence they had collected, they knew that in the carpets in front of the maid's room, there was an enormous amount of blood. And in fact, there was then a blood trail that went to the bathroom. And in the bathtub in that bathroom is where they believed that Buck had cut up the two women. The first witness, Kathy, that they had come onto the stand was Mrs. Nelson, who was Isabella's sister. Isabella and her sister were very close, and she was one of the ones who lived in Edinburgh and had met her in Blackpool, and they were going to spend the weekend together. Now, she testified about the abuse that not only had her sister told her about, but that she had actually witnessed firsthand when she was staying at her sister's home. She specified one incident that happened about a year before the murder. She said she received a telegram from Buck, and the contents of which she did not address in court, but whatever it was enough to worry her to go down to Lancaster to see her sister. It was about 200 miles away. This was a trek. Once there, Buck told Isabella's sister that Isabella had tried to gas herself. And of course, it could mean anything. In 1935, it could mean anything. And so I looked that up too. And yeah. Basically, it was carbon monoxide from domestic coal gas is what people used to try and commit suicide. Now, it didn't work. And Buck told Isabella's sister that Isabella had done this to try and ruin him. And she'd done it before. And he was angry. And Buck kept saying, I've been nothing but good and kind to her. I've loved her. I don't know why she's trying to ruin me. So Isabella's sister sat down next to her in bed and said, tell me the truth. Tell me what really happened. And before Isabella could respond, Buck hauled off and slapped Isabella across the face and screamed at her not to lie, that she had to tell the truth. Can you imagine being a sister and seeing that happen?
Oh, no. The guy would be dead.
Right. Isabella's sister continued her testimony by saying Isabella asked her if the sister would take her home with her to Edinburgh. Buck's response to that was that if you try and take my children from me, I will slit both your throats. And I'm sure he said it in a much angrier way than I just did. Because then he calmed down and became very nice.
That's what it said in the newspaper.
Right. That's exactly what it said.
Then he calmed down and became very nice.
Yeah. Isabella's sister culminated her testimony by talking about the time they spent together in Blackpool at the Illuminations and said that Isabella had had a great time up until the time came close for her to have to return home. When Isabella left and they said their goodbyes, the plan was is that Isabella was going to come back the next day and spend Sunday with them. But she never did, and they never saw her again.
Another person that took the stand was one of Buck Ruxton's patients, and her name was Mary Hampshire. And she testified that on the 15th, so this is the last day that, you know, Mary and Isabella had been seen, that she was at the doctor's office. And the doctor asked her and her husband to help tidy his house. And it didn't say this in the paper, and we're not 100% sure, but we do know that, you know, Buck took on patients who couldn't pay him and he operated a barter system. So it is quite possible that Mary and her husband couldn't pay. And so it's a matter of go clean my house. While on the stand, and I don't know why I was so amused by this, but while on the stand, she testified that the bathtub in his home was filthy. She said it was a dark yellow stain up until the top 6 inches of the rim. And she told him, I can't believe you have such a dirty bathtub for a doctor.
Exactly. Could you imagine?
So Buck had told Mary, I had to remove the carpets in the hallway and on the stairs for decorators. They're in the backyard. And I'd like you to take them home and clean them for me. So the two of them go outside and they see the carpet pads, they see the rugs, and they're filthy and stained. When she took them home, she said she started pouring water all over them, and it was clear to her that this was actually blood.
And these were the carpet runners on the hallway, which is why prosecutors believe Isabella and Mary were killed in front of the maid's room, with them then being dragged down to the bathroom.
One of the witnesses who took the stand was the housekeeper. And she said that on September 15th, the day that Isabella was last seen, she arrives at the home. And Buck meets her at the door and says, Isabella's not home. She's gone for a few days. Don't bother coming today. It's okay. Have a nice day. So she leaves. She comes back the next day and she finds Buck tearing off the bottom of what appeared to be blood-stained curtains and putting them in the fire. This is the most disgusting part. He then gave her the remainder of the curtains to use as rags to do her housework.
Why would that not raise questions?
The same housekeeper also testified that at one point after Isabella was gone, Buck was in his bed and he kind of sat her on the bed and was like, listen to this. And he starts reading to her about the bodies that were found in Moffitt. And he says to her, so you've seen that these bodies are of a man and a woman. So it's not our two. It's not Isabella and Mary. And so she thought that was a little odd.
It was a little odd.
A little odd.
So after the sister and the help came up and testified first, the prosecutors ended by bringing up the kind of meat of the evidence they had, and that was their forensic scientists. This trial actually, Kathy, became a landmark case for forensic science going forward, because at this trial, they used different techniques in terms of identifying bodies and time of death and whatnot that had never been used before, and they were successfully able to bring this to a jury. One of the things that they did was they brought about the use of entomology, and that is, you'd mentioned that there were maggots all over the parts of the bodies that were found. They actually were able to use the maggots to determine when these two women died. And that had never been done at trial. But honestly, the big thing that they had never done before is they used photographic superimposition. So what this meant is, as we said, they had been able to put the skulls back together for these two women. And so they took a portrait that had been taken and superimposed it over the skull to show that it really outlined the face identically. And no two people are going to have the same face outline and shape, including the woman who they thought was a man with her lantern jaw. When they superimposed it over Isabella, it was an identical match. And then, of course, the same thing happened for Mary. The other thing that happened is one of the anatomy professors at the university came in, and what he did is he had taken casts of the feet they found. One was for Mary, obviously, one was for Isabella. And so in court in front of the jury, he put a cotton stocking over it, which I'm sure we'd call a sock these days, but it was a stocking.
Right.
And for Mary, they took her foot and he put it into a black shoe that had belonged to her. And it was an exact fit. And then he did the same thing with one of Isabella's feet and again, put it into a shoe that belonged to her. And it too was an exact match.
So is that what, that's where Johnny Cochran got it? If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
I actually believe it's true. Prove it wrong.
So after the prosecution rested its case, the defense was up and they only had one witness, and that was Dr. Buck Ruxton, who took the stand and was a complete and total train wreck. Emotional fits of crying, sometimes talking so high they couldn't understand, sometimes talking so low they couldn't understand. He was absolutely an emotional train wreck. And so the jurors were trying to strain to hear his words. But what was very clear was that he emphatically denied killing his beloved Isabella and Mary Rogerson, whom he referred to as a dear child. On cross-examination, the prosecutor asked, "Isn't it true that you believe Isabella was having an affair for some time?" And his response, I have to read it, it was, "Isabella has done some silly things that would not be done by a sensible woman."
Well, you know how women are.
Exactly. That's why we can't be on juries.
I know.
We do silly things.
And they're not sensible, and we don't know why we do it.
I don't even know, but we have so much fun doing it.
I know.
So then the prosecution then asked, "Where do you think Miss Ruxton is?" And he responded by telling a story. He basically said, "Isabella has done this trick, and it's a trick of going to Holland without a passport. If she can do that, there's no telling where she is." Okay.
And is that an answer?
Right. When asked if he had been able to find one single person who saw his wife or Mary Rogerson leave his house on the morning of the 15th, he said he had made many inquiries. So the trial lasted 11 days, and then the case went to the jury. After deliberating for just 1 hour, Dr. Buck Ruxton was found guilty of murdering his wife and sentenced to death by hanging.
A private citizen actually started a petition for clemency for the sake of the three children who would be orphaned if Buck Ruxton was actually hanged.
And remember, this was a small community, but this was a, I'm going to say, fantastical trial. Fantastical is not the right word, but it was highly, highly publicized because of all the science they used during right. the trial.
Well, and the upstanding citizen.
Correct. A doctor was accused of murdering his wife, and the prosecution kept referring to Mary Rogerson's murder as well.
Which wouldn't be allowed today. Prejudicial?
For sure.
Good job.
I'm almost ready to graduate.
But yeah, so this petition went around. It got a ton of signatures.
It got 8,000 signatures. And in a town of around 2,000 now.
Where it was being walked around.
Yeah.
Walked around. Yeah.
So actually, they also had it at markets and things like that.
Okay.
And church on Sunday and whatnot. But did this in a really fast amount of time as well.
Yeah. So 8,000 people wanted this guy to get a pass, essentially.
And the people who signed it included businessmen, patients, prosecution witnesses. Reading in the newspaper, Kath, it looked like there were a number of reasons why they did it. One of them was, of course, the orphans. You don't ever want to see children orphaned like that. And apparently they had never been told about what had happened to their mother and father. After their mother was killed and their father was arrested, they went off to live with family friends and were not told why.
Oh.
Because at the time they were 7, 5, and 3.
Right.
So, and it's not like they were, you know, online or watching TV.
Right. But I mean, 8,000 people, that is so significant. Yeah. And word spread.
Definitely. And so in addition to the orphan thing, there were also a number of people who thought he was innocent. We were talking about the fact that one of the things we read is that a lot had to do with the infidelity of his wife. Mm-hmm. And how we thought there were probably a number of men who thought that that was justifiable.
We read an article about it. And basically, this article was saying that at the time, it was justified. I'm not going to say justified. That wasn't the word. But it was, I guess, to justified. A certain extent. Because yeah. they were like trying to excuse it. Like she was a floozy and she was cheating on her husband.
Right.
And the end. A lot of people who have influence are asking us now today to sign petitions and sign this and sign that. When my husband was a homicide detective, they had to work overnight. They called it working the desk, and it was where you were the one fielding phone calls. And a lot of the phone calls, like let's say a suicide came in, the homicide detectives, whoever on call, still had to roll out. Anyway, he's working the desk one night and somebody calls in. There had been a suicide, and I cannot remember what city in LA County it had been in, but there was a suicide, and I feel like it was a death by hanging. I feel like somebody had hung himself, and it was somewhere near City Hall. And I wish I could remember the city. But anyway, he's working the desk, and he, you know, picks up the phone, and somebody is saying, you know, on behalf of so-and-so, I would like a, and they had this canned speech. Like it was like a prepared inquiry. And then immediately he got like 4 more, 5 more, 6 more. And he's like, what the hell is this? And so he asked some lady, like, what is this? The death has been investigated. It's a suicide. People were accusing the sheriff's department, I believe, of hiding video footage, something like that, something. And my husband's like, what? Why is everyone calling in tonight right now? And it was some major celebrity. I want to say it was Kim Kardashian, but I cannot be sure. But, and she goes to Killer Destinations Law School, so we can't talk trash about her.
But she also, as you'll recall, we had the case of Kevin Cooper that we covered that happened in Chino Hills.
Yeah.
And she was on it for years and years. He's innocent. He's innocent. He was accused of slaughtering a husband and wife, their son, and their son's friend. Everything was, he's innocent, he's innocent, he's innocent. She gets the governor to say, all right, let's run a DNA test.
We're going
to
reopen the case,
yep,
run a DNA test.
Thank you, Kim. You're the best. I think he called her Kimmy, but I'm not sure. The DNA test came back that it was him.
Yeah.
So it is one of those things, like, good for her for wanting to help.
Yeah.
Slow your roll.
But on that night, my husband said he wanted to, like, put a fork in his eye because he just kept getting call after call after call after call of everyone saying this identical paragraph. That's what this petition of 8,000 people in this, you know,
2,000 people town.
Exactly.
Did they check the signatures?
You know what? That is a damn good question, Kathy. Did they check those signatures?
Ultimately, however, the appeal was denied and he was hanged on May 12th, 1936. That same day in the Daily Record, the newspaper that we've used for a lot of this, it was revealed that he had written a will in the days leading up to the trial. And what he did is he put notes of what he wished for his children, his orphan children. He wanted his then 3-year-old son to follow in his father's footsteps and become a doctor. And he wanted his 2 daughters, who were 7 and 5 at the time, to become nurses.
He wanted them to do all the hard work. Everyone knows the nurses do the hard work.
Do all the hard work. It was also his wish, and I thought this was interesting, Kathy. It was also his wish that they move the children out of that area of England, perhaps southern England, because he did not want them to grow up with the onus of being those Ruxton children. The kids were never followed up on. I'm sure they were, but not in a way that was public. I don't know if that happened with them, but I do know that they were placed in an orphanage. They did not go with relatives. They did not go with family friends.
And you don't know why they were placed in an orphanage.
Correct. Honestly, part of me thought, was it the stigma that would have been attached to a family member who did this?
I
don't
bet.
Know. I mean, 1935 is such a hard time to wrap my head around because who knows what it was like back then.
Right.
Then, Kathy, the day after Buck Ruxton was hanged, the front page of the Daily Record ran a headline that left the nation gobsmacked, which is my favorite British word.
That's good. Gobsmacked.
Apparently, on the day that Buck was arrested, so 6 months prior, he was able to surreptitiously give an envelope to a local reporter for the Daily Record. And what he said to the man was, if I'm found guilty, you need to publish this. But if I'm acquitted, I want it back. As we all know, he was found guilty. And so the very next day, the front page of the Daily Record carried a copy of this note. It was dated the day after his arrest, and it said, I killed Mrs. Ruxton in a fit of temper because I thought she had been with a man. I was mad at the time. Mary Rogerson was present at the time. I had to kill her. And then he ended this with his signature.
So the prosecution's theory was 100% correct.
Exactly.
And a lot of the people who thought he was innocent and signed the petition were proven wrong. Thanks for listening.
Follow us, subscribe, rate us, case suggestions.
Right.
And thanks for listening.
In October, if I serve on a jury, I'll let you all know how it goes.
And you'll know because we won't have an episode that week.
Exactly.
We really need to get ahead.
We need to put some in the bank.
Exactly.
In the bank.
All right.
All right. Thanks, folks.